Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, on behalf of the editorial team. You can follow me on social media at History Chappie or at Versus History. But today, more importantly, I am joined by a very special guest. His name is Porrick Coffey, and he is the author of a brand new book entitled This Day in Irish History. Porrick, welcome to Versus History. Congratulations on the new book. It's an absolute doozy. We're delighted to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure really is all ours. Let's get straight into it, shall we, my good sir? Tell us all about you, your background, and this fantastic new book, This Day in Irish History.
So I was born in Sligo in the west of Ireland, and I grew up in Tubbercurry, which is the sort of the second largest town in County Sligo. And I attended university in Dublin and University College Dublin, UCD, between 2005 and 2010. I took a year off in the middle of that. My undergraduate was actually in English and philosophy, so it wasn't really history based. But when I did an MA, my thesis was on, it was on cinema and Northern Ireland, specifically the Troubles, which is obviously a huge source of interest for people, and many films have been made about it. So my master's was not strictly a history master's, but there was a lot of history involved. There were a lot of history books that I read, modern Irish history and British history as well. But you kind of delve into the past further. So I've always had an interest in Irish history and history more generally. And that's sort of why I wrote the book. It was sort of an opportunity for me to research something myself that I could kind of compile. And because I had an interest in it, I figured that maybe other people would have an interest in this. And we'll probably get onto this, but the book actually started as a social media account, which I started in 2018, because I noticed that on social media, anytime you logged on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you would see people commemorating dates, commemorating anniversaries. They'd say, oh, it's 50 years since this happened, or it's 100 years since that happened. You know, it could be somebody's birthday. It could be the day that somebody died. It could be the day that an historic agreement was signed or a battle was fought or anything like that. And I thought to myself, what if I were to focus exclusively on history related to Ireland? Because although Ireland would be mentioned in these social media posts that you would see, they were usually a part of a more global history. So it might mention something like the 1916 Easter Rising, which many people will have heard of, or the Good Friday Agreement, if we're talking about modern history. But I thought, what if we did that for every single day of the year? You know, what little things could we uncover? You know, because we know the big dates and we know the big events, but what about the smaller events that are maybe less celebrated, less discussed, less well known? So that's what the book was all about. It kind of came from the social media account, where I would sort of set myself a challenge of finding something interesting to talk about every day, and then expanding that into a book so that the people who follow the social media account could then say, you know, I want a little bit more detail here. I want something I could sit down and read, and or maybe give to somebody who I know is interested in this subject, but who maybe doesn't use the internet that often or doesn't have a Twitter account or a Facebook account. So that's really where it came from.
Makes absolute sense, Porrick. Okay, just before we go any further then, what is that Twitter or Instagram account? How can we follow it?
So it's just the words This Day Irish altogether. There's no spaces or underscores or anything like that. So if you search for that on Twitter and on Facebook, I believe you can find it by typing in the same thing. I know that, you know, usernames aren't as common on Facebook. You tend to find the name of the page, but they're all linked to each other. So if you find one, you should be able to find the other. And then Instagram is the same. Significantly fewer followers on Instagram, I have to say, because I haven't been as diligent with updating that as I have been with the other ones because of just various reasons. But I do update it now daily. So even though there aren't as many followers on Instagram, it is still there.
There you go then, folks. Get involved. Thank you very much indeed, Porrick. Okay, next question then. A little bit controversial to get us kicked off. And here we go. If you were advising an alien from a far away distant planet on the best two and only two places, Porrick, to visit on the island of Ireland, which places would they be and why?
So for this one, I thought I would choose one close to Sligo, where I'm from, where I was born and grew up, and then another one more generally. So for the Sligo one, I picked Benbulbin, which is a mountain in County Sligo. And that's famous for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons that it's famous that people might know is that it's where the poet William Butler Yeats is buried. Now, William Butler Yeats, W.B. Yeats, very famous Irish poet, Nobel laureate. He wasn't actually born in Sligo, but he wrote a lot of his poetry about there. And he died in France in 1939. But his last wish to his wife was, and the quote is, and I'll take it from the book because I have the book in front of me, is, "In a year's time, when the newspapers have forgotten me, dig me up and plant me in Sligo." This is what he said to his wife just before he died in France.
Wow.
And it wasn't a year later. It was actually almost a decade later. It was 1948 when his body was taken from France and reinterred in County Sligo on the orders of Sean McBride, who was at the time the Minister for External Affairs in Ireland. Sean McBride, people might know, is one of the founders of Amnesty International. So it was taken from France. His remains were taken from France and brought to Ireland and buried under Benbulbin, because he wrote a famous poem called Under Benbulbin. And a line from that poem is actually on his headstone. The line is, "Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horsemen pass by." Now, there's actually a rumor, I have to mention this, there's a rumor that the remains that were taken from France to Ireland were not actually Yeats's remains at all. They belonged to an Englishman who died in France at the time called Alfred Hollis. And there are some people who believe that there was a mix-up with the remains, and they maintain that Yeats is not actually buried in Sligo at all. But Yeats's family strenuously deny this. It's one of those things where we may never know the truth of it. But either way, it's a lovely part of the world to visit, a lovely part of Ireland to visit. And the other reason I mentioned Benbulbin is because historically there was a very famous battle fought there in the mid-6th century, about 550, 560, around that time. It's hard to put a precise year on it. And what happened was Columbkill, who was this famous saint born in County Donegal, who founded many monasteries in Ireland and in Britain as well, he controversially had transcribed and translated this book of Psalms belonging to Saint Finian, who was an abbot in County Louth. And this was a controversial thing at the time because Finian was not happy about this book of Psalms being transcribed, and a battle erupted as a result of this. And what happened is Columbkill tried to get men from Donegal, where he was from, and men in Sligo to kind of fight against those who supported Finian because of this issue. And the battle was fought there. It was called the Battle of Cúil Dhromna, and 3,000 people died. But it was sort of a Pyrrhic victory for Columbkill. He was very unhappy about it. He felt very remorseful. And he ended up moving to Scotland and to Britain more generally, where he set up many monasteries. He set up 60 monasteries in Scotland alone. But this battle was sort of seen as one of the first instances of a fight over copyright infringement. And at the time, there was a very famous quote, which a lot of Irish children learn about at school, from the High King of Ireland, who was Diarmaid MacCarville, who said, he decided that it was wrong what Columbkill had done in terms of transcribing this book. And the quote he said is, "To every cow, it's calf, to every book, it's copy," which is something you learn about in school. So Benbulbin in County Sligo is a place I would recommend. The other place I'd recommend, I'll go through this a little bit more quickly, is at Newgrange in County Meath. And we're actually recording this in December. And in December, Newgrange in County Meath is the site of many, many people, because back in the 1960s, Michael J. O'Kelly discovered that the winter solstice could be observed in Newgrange. Basically, there's an inner chamber that fills with light on the 21st of December, and it's about 60 feet long. And many, many people travel to see this. And according to O'Kelly, and some people have offered disputing claims, Newgrange itself is over 5,000 years old. Apparently predates the pyramids in Egypt by 500 years. So it's an extremely important historical site. It was declared a World Heritage Site by UNESCO in the early 1990s, 1993, I believe. So Newgrange, County Meath, obviously the site of a really kind of special place for people and a site of interest, and then Belbulben and County Sligo, just to kind of reference someplace close to home for me.
Thank you very much indeed, Porrick. Okay, then, let's segue into your book. Set the scene for us, if you will. What is this book, This Day in Irish History, all about? And why did you decide to write it in the first place?
So, as I mentioned earlier, I started the social media account, and I got a lot of interest from people, not just in Ireland, but in the UK, in North America, in Canada, in the USA, in Australia, even in continental Europe, maybe to a lesser extent, but there was still interest in it. And occasionally people would say, they would send me a message saying, is there anywhere else I can read this stuff? Because my dad would love to read this, or, you know, my uncle would love to read this, or something like that. And I thought to myself, well, what if I were to write a book that way? These people could maybe, you know, give this to the people in their lives who they know would be interested in it. The other reason is, as you know, I'm sure, and as everybody listening to this knows, social media is a very, very, you know, succinct form of communication, especially Twitter is 280 characters, which translates to, gosh, about 40 words. I'm not even sure on average. If we were to guess, I'd say maybe around 40 words, which is very, very, very short. And so you can't really get a lot of nuance in there. So what the book allowed me to do was to go into a lot more detail than I would get on Facebook or on Twitter. That isn't to say that the book is sort of, you know, too in depth. It's I hope, a very accessible book, a book that anybody can pick up and read. And it's not a tome. You know, it's quite a considerable book. It's over 100,000 words long, but because it's divided up into these short entries, each entry is about 300 or so words long. You know, you get the information, you get the facts, you get sort of an interest, and then if you're interested, you can go and do further research on it. You can maybe pick up another book on it, or you can look it up online or whatever, or listen to a podcast about it. But it's sort of a way of like whetting people's appetite to learn more about a subject, but giving them the overview. So my hope is that anyone who reads the book will come away with knowledge that they didn't know before. Even somebody who knows a lot about Irish history might say, oh, I never knew this, or I never knew that. So that was sort of the reason why I wrote the book.
Well, it certainly worked for me. It's a fantastic book too. It certainly whetted my appetite. Thank you, Porrick. Okay, and the next question then, in your view, what are the biggest misconceptions about Irish history? And how would you go about challenging these, or perhaps, if there's some truth in it, supporting them?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question that I thought about, because it's hard to know really like how you define what a misconception is. But one thing I would say is that Irish people do know a lot about their history, but they do have their blind spots, just like British people, just like American people, just like people from every country. You know, everyone has their blind spots. One thing that is commonly thought about Ireland, and I've heard it mentioned a lot, is that It's discussing Ireland's neutrality in the Second World War. Now, Ireland was neutral. And when I say Ireland, I'm referring to the Irish state, because as we know, the island of Ireland is divided between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, yeah, which many people just refer to as Ireland. And this was known as the Irish Free State for many years. So there's a lot of people will call you out no matter what term you use. If you refer to it as Ireland, they'll say you mean the Republic of Ireland. If you say the Republic of Ireland, yeah, they'll say, I don't like that name. Call it Ireland. But anyway, when I say Ireland, I'm talking about the 26 county state. It was neutral during the Second World War. It didn't even use the term Second World War. It used the term the emergency. But many, many, many Irish people fought in the Second World War with Britain and also with the United States. And when we're talking about the United States, we're talking about, you know, young Irish immigrants who would have moved there and, you know, were of fighting age and so on. But many of them did fight with Britain. So that's a misconception that I think is maybe not known. I've even heard it claimed that Ireland, not only was Ireland not neutral, but Ireland was on the side of the Nazis during the war. And this largely I would call this a misconception. This has come about largely as a result of the fact that the leader at the time, Éamon de Valera, who was the Taoiseach, visited the home of Edward Hempel, who was the German ambassador to Ireland, after Hitler's death. And that was, many people will tell you, a blunder, to put it mildly, because many people had seen Britain fight against the Nazis, had seen America fight against the Nazis, and the fact that De Valera had visited his home, many people thought was an incredibly stupid thing to do. Other people have defended him and said, you know, well, he was acting as the head of government of a neutral country and so on. But despite that, and I will say one thing about that visit is that Edward Hempel's daughter, who was living in Ireland at the time, she said that her father was not a supporter of Hitler. Now, of course, you know, that's just her word for it. And that she actually compared the death of Hitler at the time, this is much, much later, she compared it to the death of Osama bin Laden. She said, Hitler's death didn't mean a damn thing to my father. He was happy about it, like we are happy about Osama bin Laden. And she stressed that the relationship between Emma de Valera and Edward Hempel was one of friendship, and rather than it being, you know, the head of the Irish state and the German ambassador to Ireland and so on. The other thing I would mention is that I mentioned the number of Irish people, or I said that many thousands, somewhere around 66,000 Irish people from the Irish state fought with Britain, and then about 64,000 from Northern Ireland. So from the island of Ireland, we're talking over 120,000 people fighting against Nazi Germany. And of course, not everybody in Northern Ireland would be a unionist. Many of them would be unionists, very proud of their British heritage, very much wanting to remain part of the United Kingdom, but many of them would be from a background that would be more nationalist in its leaning. So a huge number of people, one of whom was Paddy Finucane, whose actual name was Brendan Finucane, who was the youngest ever wing commander of the Royal Air Force. And he was shot down flying back on a mission from France. He was 21 years of age at the time, and he's the interesting thing about him is that his background was very much a nationalist background. His father had fought in the Four Courts during the Easter Rising of 1916, but he then ended up joining the Royal Air Force, becoming a pilot, fighting for Britain against Nazi Germany. And Winston Churchill had a famous quote for him, because Churchill and De Valera at the time, they exchanged quite a few harsh words just after the war. You know, Churchill said something very negative about Hitler, about De Valera, and, you know, referenced his visiting Edward Hempel. De Valera returned in kind. It was sort of a kind of a sparring match at the time, verbal sparring match. But one thing that Churchill said that's interesting is he said, if ever I feel a bitter feeling rising in my heart about the Irish, the hands of heroes like Finucane seem to stretch out and soothe it away. That's the quote. Now, some people might hear that and focused on, you know, the first part of it where he talks about a bitter feeling. But I think it shows to you that a misconception there is that, you know, Ireland and Britain, or Ireland and England, are constantly at war with one another, when really there was a lot of cooperation. Another thing I'll say very quickly is, even though Ireland was neutral during the war, it did allow a strip of land called the Donegal Corridor, which is in the Irish state, to be used by planes flying over. And this actually reduced the unprotected gap in the mid-Atlantic by at least 100 miles. So it actually helped the Allies in the war. And this was not well known at the time. It was sort of a kind of under the table deal between the Irish government and the British government. But this is a strip of land sort of to the west of Northern Ireland. So sort of, if you know where Donegal is in Ireland, it's the top left corner of Ireland, top northwestern corner. And it's sort of a thin strip of land there that was used by planes at the time. So even though it was neutral, it was, as some people would say, neutral on the side of the Allies. So that would be one misconception about Irish history that I would seek to sort of correct, I suppose. Another misconception, very briefly, is Ireland came to be part of the United Kingdom in the very early 1800s, very early 19th century, after the Act of Union. And the Act of Union was a decision that was taken at a time when Catholics in Ireland did not have the franchise, didn't have the vote, really. It was a decision mainly taken by the Protestant representatives in Ireland. But what many people don't know about that is that many Catholics at the time supported the move, because they felt it would lead to Catholic emancipation. Now, Catholic emancipation came much later, about three decades later, around the time that Daniel O'Connell was elected an MP to the House of Commons. But it's something that isn't known at the time, that actually, far from Ireland joining the UK, or, you know, joining with Great Britain to create the UK, far from this being something that Catholics fought against, many of them supported it. Now, that's not anything to do with anyone today, but it's just, it's an historical fact that seems to get a little bit forgotten. So history is not as simple, as I'm sure you know, and your listeners know, history is not as simple as people often make it out to be. So that's another thing I would point out as maybe a misconception from both sides, from maybe sort of a British side and an Irish side about Irish history.
Transitioning into a theme you've already touched on, the relationship between England specifically and Ireland. So let's be frank then, that relationship has been troubled throughout history, to say the very least. If you were put in charge, Porrick, of forging a better future between these two nations by both governments simultaneously, what would be your top priorities and actions? Over to you. This was hypothetical.
This was another difficult question that I had to think about. And I'm just kind of speculating here. I'm not qualified to really make this make any kind of suggestion here. But I mean, it's hard to say what the British and the Irish governments respectively should do. And anyone listening to this knows right now that we're still in the midst of the UK's withdrawal from the European Union and issues over the border and issues over the Northern Ireland Protocol and all of that. Yeah. And really, it is a complex one. And it's kind of sad to see how bitter this can get. I mean, one thing I would say is, honestly, if I don't know how much people in Ireland and people in the UK listen to their leaders, I would ask the leaders to tell people to maybe spend a little bit less time on social media. And I'm aware that that's an ironic thing for me to say, because my book started as a social media account. But if you spend too much time on social media, you really get sucked into these constant arguments and sniping at one another. And it's really kind of a sea of negativity. There's a lot of great stuff about social media. Obviously, this podcast reaches many people through social media. My books, as I said many times, started as a social media account. But maybe I would say spend a little bit less time on the social media where people get sucked into arguments with strangers. And it's always anonymous strangers. It's never people showing their faces. Usually it's people with a flag in their profile. I wouldn't even say a flag of a particular country. It's always flags or emblems of some kind or another. Maybe spend a little bit less time on social media and focus on the things that the British people and the Irish people have in common, because they do have a lot in common. They're obviously different. They're different countries. They travel the world with different passports. They have different elections. They're different people, but there's a lot in common. There's a sort of very similar climate, very similar culture. You know, I mean, if you go into an Irish home any day of the week, there's a very good chance they'll be watching a British soap opera or a British football team. And likewise, you know, consider the contributions that Irish people have made to Britain in terms of entertainment, show business, broadcasting in the last 100 years. I mean, everybody knows Eamon Andrews, Terry Wogan. We go to the modern day, Graham Norton, Dara O'Brien, writers like Edna O'Brien, who's obviously Irish but lives in the UK. I mean, there's massive, massive sort of, for want of a better word, cross-pollination between the two countries in terms of culture. So I think maybe spend a little bit less time on social media and a little bit of time focusing on the differences and a little bit more time focusing on the things that they have in common. That would be my advice. But I don't know how that would sound coming out of a politician's mouth.
Well, it's pretty good life advice, to be honest, Porrick. Anything else you'd like to add? We're happy to move on to the next question.
We can move on to the next question.
Let's go for it then. All right, then. So championing and showcasing underrepresented histories is a key focus for Versus History and many other groups too. And could you tell us about the achievements and contributions of some minority groups, whoever they may be, to and in Irish history?
This was a little harder to think about. One thing I would say is that Ireland has not had the best history when it comes to representing half of its population, namely women, or maybe a little more than half of its population. There have been a lot of laws, particularly since Ireland became independent, that have maybe been behind the times. Many people will be aware that in 2018, there was a referendum in Ireland on lifting a constitutional ban on abortion. And I'm aware that abortion is a very controversial subject. But if you compare that to the UK, specifically to England and Wales, because it wasn't available in Northern Ireland. But abortion has been available since the 60s. So there's a huge difference there. Obviously, in America, they have Roe versus Wade, although many people are kind of trying to change that now at the moment in the United States. But historically, Ireland hasn't always been great in terms of women and its representation of women. What I would say is there have been exceptions to this. One of the exceptions is in 1918, the first woman ever elected to the House of Commons, because back in 1918, all of Ireland was part of the UK, part of the United Kingdom. The first woman was a woman representing an Irish constituency, and that was Constance Markievicz. She did not take her seat in the House of Commons. She was an abstentionist candidate, which meant that she, you know, stood for election, was elected, but did not go to the House of Commons because she, you know, did not recognize the authority of the House of Commons or the authority of the British government. She was actually a member of Dáil Éireann, which was the revolutionary parliament set up in 1919. Subsequently, she became a candidate for the party Fianna Fáil, which is currently in power in Ireland. Their leader, Micheál Martin, is the Taoiseach of Ireland, the leader of the Irish government. But that was a first in Irish history and in British history as well, in the history of the UK. The first woman ever elected to the House of Commons happened in Ireland in 1918. Another thing that happened post-independence, so post-1922, was in 1925, Una Keogh became the first woman stockbroker in the world. She joined the Dublin stock market that year in 1925. And just to put a bit of contrast on this, this was an unusual thing at the time. So the first woman to join the New York Stock Exchange was in 1967. And the first woman to join the London Stock Exchange was in 1973. So quite a few years later. So this was very unusual at the time. That doesn't mean that she didn't face challenges. She did, of course, face challenges at the time, as did all women in Ireland. But the fact that she was able to join there shows that there was some of that spirit in the early part of the Irish state, the spirit of equality, which didn't always come to the fore. So yeah, another thing about Irish history and about women is that Ireland is the only country in the world to elect two female heads of state consecutively. Now, the head of state in Ireland is the president. Current president is Michael D. Higgins. This is largely a ceremonial role. It's sort of the equivalent of the monarch in the UK, sort of the equivalent of Queen Elizabeth. The role of the president is supposed to be an apolitical one. But in the early 90s, Mary Robinson was elected the first woman president of Ireland. And then after she left office, Mary McAleese was elected the second woman president of Ireland. And this was the first time in history that this has happened, that two female heads of state had been elected consecutively. Of course, there have been heads of state that are appointed, but this is the first time that the voters actually put those women in power, albeit a power that's a very limited power. It's more of a ceremonial position. So those are some examples representation of women, which hasn't, as I said, always been the best. But that was sort of what jumped out at me. There probably are other examples. I mean, we could get into people of color, we could get into minority groups. I honestly don't feel qualified enough to comment on that. I just simply don't know enough about it right now. But that is something that I'm sure there's a lot of it would be a rich source for research and for people to talk about. Many of you might know Irish Nigerian writer Emma Dibiri. I know she's written a lot of books about this, or she's written a couple of books about this, but she's written about this in detail, about being growing up in Ireland, not being white, having a background that was different from the majority, and sort of what that was like. But yeah, in terms of representation of minority groups, that was something that kind of jumped out at me.
Moving towards the end now, and it will come as no surprise, I'm sure, to any of the listeners to say that emigration has been a distinguishing feature of Irish history. My own personal anecdotal history, I suppose, speaks to that. It's when my ancestors moved, many of them to America, but a few to the UK. And what have been the key features of this thing, so emigration, and how does this feature in your book? So emigration and Ireland, Porrick, over to you.
So it features quite heavily in the book because the concept of the book is that every day of the year, 1st of January, 2nd of January, 3rd of January, I talk about an event in Irish history or event in history that involves Ireland in some way. And the very, very first entry in the book, January 1st, 1892, was the first immigrant ever to pass through Ellis Island who was Annie Moore, and she was from County Cork, and she passed through with her brothers, Anthony and Philip. She was 17 years of age at the time. And she's somebody who has been referenced, you know, many, many times in Irish history. There is a song written by Brendan Graham called Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, all about this. And in fact, her voyage through Ellis Island was referenced in 2008 by Barack Obama, who was then running to be president of the United States. He was the Democratic nominee at the time. There was an event in Calvary Cemetery in Queens, which is where she and her family ended up living, which was read out, at which a letter was read out by Obama, in which he said, "The idea of honoring those who came before you by sacrificing on behalf of those who follow is at the heart of the American experience. Irish Americans like your ancestors and mine from County Offaly understood this well." Many people will know that Obama, when he visited Ireland, visited people in County Offaly with whom he had some lineage. It was going back quite a bit. You know, it wasn't like one generation or two generations, but still, they're very, very proud, if you go to County Offaly, of Obama having roots there. There was actually a song at the time called "There's No One More Irish Than Barack Obama." It's kind of a silly song, novelty song, yes. But you know, it shows how much the Irish love it when somebody who has some Irish lineage does well abroad, which is another feature of emigration. I mean, emigration, you mentioned emigration to the UK. That's obviously been a huge, huge, huge target for Irish emigrants, the United States as well. Lesser known would be France. So in the late 1600s, there was a thing called the flight of the wild geese, which was when about 12,000 Irish Jacobite soldiers, so supporters of James, King James II, fled Ireland to France and spread throughout France and throughout the continent, one of whom was a man called Anthony McCartan, who was from County Down. And he was the ancestor of Charles de Gaulle, the future French president, who was president, of course, during the Second World War. Now, of course, Charles de Gaulle had lineage from France and from probably other European countries, but he did trace his lineage back to the late 1600s, 1691 it was, and when this event, the flight of the wild geese, took place. And in the 60s, he visited Dublin, de Gaulle did, and a ceremony was held for these distant relatives. So, you know, when we talk about Irish emigration, we talk about parts of the world where Irish people have gone. Of course, we tend to think of English-speaking countries like the UK, Australia, Canada, United States, etc. But there are also other parts of the world where they have gone and where their ancestors have ended up as well. So it's a huge part of Irish history. And I did try to touch upon that in the book. And there are several entries in the book which touch upon that very subject.
Thank you so much. Obviously, the American story and to an extent the English story, the Canadian also, and Australian too, Ned Kelly, relatively well known. But France, I had absolutely no idea that France featured in that story whatsoever. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. I suppose it remains for us to say then, so is there anything else you'd like to mention before we conclude that my limited and short-sighted questions haven't given you the chance to address that you would have liked to have said about your book, Pori?
Not really, other than I hope that people will maybe seek it out if they are interested in learning about Irish history. It's meant to be a very palatable book, a very accessible book. It's not a book that you necessarily need to read from cover to cover. I mean, if you do, that's great, because you'll take in everything that the book covers. But it's not written in chronological order, although there is a list of chronological events at the back of the book. So you might find yourself looking at an entry and going, that one doesn't interest me as much, but maybe the next one will, or the one after that. So it's a way of getting a sort of a crash course in Irish history. And there are other books out there that probably go into more detail, but sometimes those books can be a little bit intimidating. You know, you have to start at the beginning, work your way through, and maybe some parts of it appeal to you more than others, but you kind of have to stick with it going from you know, page to page to page. This book is a book you can either sit down and read from cover to cover, or it's a book that you can sort of dip in and out of. You can use it as a reference book. You can go to the index and go to the chronology and think, I want to read about Ireland in the 1960s or in the mid 18th century or the mid 19th 19th century. I want to see what was going on then. And then you can go to that specific page and read about that specific event. And the other thing is it might kind of spark your interest in another subject, which I kind of mentioned earlier, which is sort of, you know, another reason why I wrote the book. So somebody might read about Ireland in the Second World War. They might read a couple of the entries in the book where I touch upon that and get an idea that it was a little bit more complex than it's sometimes portrayed as being. And then, you know, there are books written exclusively about that subject, or there are books written exclusively about, you know, the subject I previously mentioned, the flight of the wild geese when these defeated Jacobite soldiers went to France. So that was sort of the point of the book. So I do hope that if people are interested in the subject and maybe want to learn more about Irish history, that they'll consider this as a book to read, because it is meant to be an accessible book. And I'm hoping it's an accessible book that will maybe, you know, spark their interest in Irish history and have them come away learning something that they didn't know before.
You've certainly achieved that, Porrick. I mean, for myself, I've got an exceptionally Irish name and some very strong Irish ancestry, although it's quite distant. And to all intents and purposes, I am an English chap, although I do live in the Kingdom of Bahrain. Now, I bought it exactly for the purpose that you're talking about, just to sort of dip my toe to get an hors d'oeuvre, to get an entry point or a gateway into Irish history. And it certainly delivered on that purpose. It's given me so much breadth. And if I wanted to go deeper on any particular topic, it sort of gave me a gateway into doing that. So you've absolutely 100% achieved that. It's a fantastic book. It is very accessible. It's very gripping. It's very, very entertaining, albeit with some of the more, I'd say, dark elements of Irish history. No one needs to say Oliver Cromwell's name too loudly, but there you have it. And it certainly helped me feel a bit closer to a part of my own lineage and life that I hitherto knew very little about, which is Ireland. So thank you very much indeed, Porrick. Just remind us before we say goodbye then, the title of the book, who's it published by and where can we get it?
So it's thanks, Patrick, for all that. The title is This Day in Irish History, and it's published by O'Brien Press in Dublin. And you can get it from all the usual sources online and so on, and hopefully in good bookshops. Obviously, we're in the middle of COVID and there are supply chain issues and so on. But hopefully, if you want to get your hands on a copy, you should be able to do so on the social media accounts, as I mentioned earlier. If you just type in This Day Irish, you should be able to find it there on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and so on.
Nice one. Thank you. Okay, so it's Porrick Coffee and it's entitled This Day in Irish History. And why not go and pick up a copy? It's an absolutely fantastic book. So thank you for writing it, Porrick, and thank you for joining us on the Versus History podcast. We'd be delighted to have you back anytime that you want to come back and join us.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
All the best.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.